Welcome back, Hemming Brainiacs, to the Hemming Brainiac List podcast. The podcast where we do things excellently. We are talking about Book 2, Chapter 19, Part 1 of The Red and the Black. I broke the chapter up into two parts, although the first part was most of the chapter, and then tonight's reading will be pretty short, only about two pages. I know, it's a bit funny. Jan Brunn said, can I just say I'm not a fan of the epigrams. Glad that trend is dead and buried. I guess Stendhal was mocking the literary convention by plastering his book with fake ones. That being said, thanks, Swim said the Mama Fishy, for always providing background on these pointless tidbits. Yeah, they don't add much to the story, do they? I don't really think I've taken much notice of any of them. You just kind of read them. They're cryptic. You don't know what they're on about. You don't know if it's a real quote or is another one of his fake ones. I don't know. I don't know why he's done that. Oh yeah, I forgot to read the discussion prompts. Oops, that's my bad. Discussion prompts. What were your thoughts on the author's little aside, describing how he is a mere mirror of the world and not to hate the player but to hate the game? Narrator seems quite adamant that love operates differently in Paris. Now, Laura Weistich said, regarding the fake epigrams, sorry, I'm jumping all over the place at the moment. Was he trying to mock the literary convention by plastering fake epigrams throughout the books? Could be. Matilda and some of the other characters were coming up with epigrams earlier in the book. It certainly seems to have been the fashion in that society. Cutilli said, I think it wasn't a good choice to break up this chapter, but I suppose there was a time constraint involved. I read the whole chapter and it is one of the better ones, if we ignore the awkward narrator's interruption in between. Going to comment tomorrow in order not to spoil anything. I kind of agree, actually. It wasn't the best place to break up the chapter, and it wasn't the best chapter to break up, but there was a couple of reasons why I did it. One is that yesterday I was a bit pressed for time, and also that there was a break in the chapter there, you know, an actual paragraph break, which very few of them in this book. I think it's probably like the second or third one in the whole novel so far. And so it was a good moment to have a break, but also I kind of knew what that last two pages, what was going to happen after the break. You know, we all know what's going to happen, don't we? I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to say that they're about to hook up again. It's just so obvious. I haven't actually read the next few pages, but I don't know. I'm 95% sure that's what's about to happen. And my thought process was this. I thought, if they hook up and that's how the chapter ends, then all the discussion will be about that. And I do want to discuss that, but also a few interesting things had happened in the chapter so far that I really wanted to have a conversation about. So I thought, if we read this last little bit, the conversation will move away from this other interesting thing, which was, well, the discussion prompts, especially the narrator's aside, you know. And actually it wasn't even a narrator's aside, it was an author's aside. And I just thought that was the weirdest thing. I've never seen anything like that in a novel. It wasn't the narrator breaking the fourth wall or the narrator having an aside. It was the author. Because there was things like saying how it's all just made up and they're not real characters. Something along those lines. Which is so weird to put in the middle of a narrative. You know, like to the narrator, it's not fiction. If that makes sense. Like the narrator is part of the universe of the story. So it wasn't the narrator saying that, because they were saying it's just a made-up story, you know? So it's like Stendhal hasn't identified the difference between the author and the narrator. They're not the same thing. And I don't know. It was also interesting. Another thing about the aside that was interesting was that he was saying how, I think he said something like, no one would sympathize with this female character, or no one would believe that she would act in this way, or something like that. But that he kind of acknowledges that and just says that, you know, not to blame the author for the unrealistic behavior, but to just blame that he's holding up a mirror of what can happen in society. Something like that. That's really poorly paraphrased, but it was something along those lines. And that was interesting too, because we'd kind of had some discussions about that. Especially when it comes to, like, you know, females doing what is expected of them or not doing what's expected of them. And in those cases, is it the fault of the author for putting those expectations on them or for breaking those expectations, that kind of thing. In our previous conversations about, like, misogyny via the author and that kind of stuff like that. So anyway, I just thought it would be interesting to stop and talk about that author's note, because it was so weird. I've never seen an author's note just in brackets in the middle of a narrative. It's so sloppy and unnecessary. It was really strange. Non-creative handle said, I feel like I'm watching a train wreck. This is the point when you grab your friend and say she isn't worth it. She's crazy. Move on. They're both a bit crazy. I don't know. They both seem so immature suddenly, right? Like, not that they seemed terribly mature, and Julian didn't really seem, you know, overly mature. He's always been fairly juvenile. But you kind of think that as the novel progresses, he'd become more mature. But this is, he's getting more carried away with this romance than he ever did with the previous one with Madame de Renal. So it's like he's regressing. Non-creative handle said, the narrator's aside was interesting. I went back and read it when I saw it was one of the discussion prompts. The particular line quoted above, up above, read like it was in reference to Matilda. Incredibly refreshing if that's the case, because female promiscuity is not something that's been historically celebrated. Overall, the entire aside to me had the sentiment of, yeah, they're crazy, just stick with me. It was like, it was too apologetic, you know, like, the author shouldn't have in brackets, like, something like that. It's like he lost all his authority as an author in that moment for me. And you've kind of got to have confidence in what you're saying as an author. Otherwise, your readers will lose confidence in what you're saying if you're not sure of it. And that was, yeah, I don't know. It was just a shaky, weird thing. Well, not many people took the bait to talk about that author's aside, and I did a little bit of Googling to try to find some stuff written about it. I thought maybe, you know, it would be interesting to see some other takes on it, but can't really find anything about that particular bit of the novel, strangely enough. So I guess that's it. That's as deep as we're going to dive into it, because I don't really know what to make of it. The heck? Yeah, I don't know what to make of it. I don't know what to say about it. Just that it was very, very strange. Now, the second discussion prompt, love being different in Paris. No one really commented on that either, but he keeps comparing romance in the novel to romance as it plays out in Paris. And I don't know. Why is that so different? Why is that such a thing? I just found that interesting as well. Anyway, that's the discussion for this chapter. I suppose we'll finish the chapter and then we'll dive into phase two of these guys' little romance, I suppose. I guess that's what's about to happen. All right, here we go. Second part of the chapter. Who could describe the excess of Julian's happiness? Matilda's was almost as great. She inveighed against herself, denounced herself to him. "Punish me for my wicked pride," she said to him, her arms hugging him so that he could scarcely breathe. "You are my master. I am your slave. On my knees I must crave your pardon for trying to rebel." She left his arms and threw herself at his feet. "Yes, you are my master," she went on, intoxicated by love and delight. "Reign forever over me. Punish your slave harshly if she tries to rebel." In another moment she tore herself from his arms, lit the candle, and Julian had the greatest difficulty in the world in preventing her from cutting off all her hair on one side. "I want to be able to remind myself," she told him, "that I am your servant. If ever vile pride should lead me astray, show me this hair and tell me it's no longer a matter of love. It's not a question of whatever mood your soul may feel just now. You have sworn to obey. Obey on your honour." But it would be wiser to have done with the description of such a pitch of distraction and felicity. Julian's virtue was equal to his happiness. "I must climb back down the ladder now," he told Matilda, when he saw daylight appearing on the distant eastern chimneys beyond the garden. "The sacrifice I'm imposing on myself is worthy of you. I am depriving myself of some hours of the most amazing happiness the human soul could possibly enjoy. It's a sacrifice I make to your reputation. If you see into my heart, you will do justice to the violence I am inflicting upon myself. Will you always be for me as you are now? But honour calls, and that's enough. You should know that from our first meeting, not all the suspicions were directed against thieves. Monsieur de la Mole has set a watch in the garden. Monsieur de Cruznoir is surrounded by spies, and they know what he does every night." At this idea, Matilda burst out laughing. Her mother and one of the serving women were woken up. All of a sudden, they called to her through the door. Julian looked at her. She turned pale as she scolded the chambermaid and did not deign to return a word to her mother. "But if they think of opening the window, they will see the ladder," said Julian. He clasped her once more in his arms, threw himself upon the ladder, and slid rather than climbed down it. In an instant he was on the ground. 3 seconds later, the ladder was under the limes in the alley, and Matilda's honour saved. Coming to his senses, Julian found that he was all covered in blood and almost naked. He had hurt himself in sliding down so precipitously. His intense happiness had restored all the vigour of his character. Had 20 men come on him at that moment, attacking them single-handed would have merely been an additional pleasure. Fortunately, his military prowess was not put to the test. He stowed the ladder in its usual place. He replaced the chain that fastened it. He did not forget to smooth over the marks the ladder had left in the beds of the exotic flowers below Matilda's window. As he ran his hand in the dark over the damp earth, making sure the prints were entirely effaced, he felt something fall onto his hands. It was a whole side of Matilda's hair that she had cut off and thrown down to him. She was at her window. "That is what your servant presents to you," she said quite loudly, the mark of eternal obedience. "I abjure the use of my reason. Be my master." Julian, overcome, was on the point of picking up the ladder and climbing up to her again. In the end, reason prevailed. Getting back into the hotel from the garden was not an easy matter. He succeeded in breaking in via a cellar door. Once in the house, he was obliged to force the door of his own room as quietly as possible. In his confusion, he had left everything in the little room he had just got out of so fast, even down to the key in his coat pocket. "If only," he thought, "she remembers to hide all those material remains." At last, exhaustion overcame happiness, and as the sun was rising, he fell into a deep slumber. The lunch bell had great difficulty in waking him. He appeared in the dining room soon afterwards. Matilda came in. Julian's pride had a moment of pure joy in seeing the love that sparkled in the eyes of this young woman, so beautiful and so surrounded by homage. But soon his prudence felt cause for alarm. Under the pretense of having had a little time for her coiffure, Matilda had done her hair in a way that let Julian see at first glance the full extent of the sacrifice she had made for him in cutting it the previous night. If so beautiful a countenance had been capable of being ruined by anything, Matilda would have succeeded in ruining it. One whole side of her lovely ash blonde hair was cut to within an inch, half an inch of her head. At lunch, Matilda's whole behaviour was in accord with this primary rash act. It was as though she had set out to let the whole world know of her mad passion for Julian. It was fortunate that on that particular day, Monsieur de la Mole and the Marquise were much preoccupied with some impending promotions to the Blue Riband, in which Monsieur de Chaulnes had not been included. Towards the end of the meal, it occurred to Matilda, talking to Julian, to call him my master. He flushed to the whites of his eyes. Whether by chance or at the insistence of Madame de la Mole, Matilda was not left alone for a moment that day. In the evening, however, while passing from the dining room to the salon, she found a chance to say to Julian, "Are you going to think this is an excuse on my part? Mama has just decided that one of her women will spend all night in my apartment." The day went by in a flash. Julian was at the peak of his happiness. From 7 o'clock the next morning, he installed himself in the library. He hoped that Mademoiselle de la Mole would deign to appear there. He had written her an infinitely long letter. He did not catch sight of her until several hours later at lunch. Today, her hair was done up with the greatest care. The place where the locks were cut off had been concealed with a miraculous art. She looked at Julian once or twice, but with calmly polite eyes. There was no question of calling him my master. Julian's astonishment affected his breathing. Matilda was reproaching herself with almost everything she had done for him. On mature consideration, she had decided that he was a person who, though not entirely commonplace, did not stand out from the ranks sufficiently to deserve all the wild acts of folly she had dared commit for him. And altogether, she was scarcely thinking of love. That day she was tired of love. As for Julian, the pitchings of his heart were those of a boy of 16. Terrible doubt, astonishment, and despair filled it by turns throughout the whole of lunch, which seemed to him to go on for an age. As soon as he could decently get up from table, he dashed, rather than ran, to the stable, saddled his horse himself, and set off at a gallop. He dreaded shaming himself through some weakness. "I must deaden my heart through physical weariness," he said to himself, galloping through the woods of Meudon. "What have I done, what have I said, to deserve such a fall from grace? I must not do anything or say anything today," he resolved as he returned to the hotel. "I must be as dead physically as I am morally. Julian is no longer alive. It is his corpse that still stirs." All right, there we go. Quite dramatic, Julian. There's another chapter done. Have your say on the subreddit. Thanks very much for listening, and I'll see ya tomorrow.